Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. Today I'm honored to have as my guest Pete Hamill. We'll be discussing Mr. Hamill's new novel, North River, recently published by Little Brown. And first of all, Pete, thanks for taking time out of a busy schedule to talk with us today.
It's a pleasure, believe me. Thank you.
Pete, I started reading your work really when you wrote A Drinking Life back in 1995. And I also read your memoir, Downtown, and that piqued my interest in your life, and then I started reading your fiction, and I think that most of the authors I've had on the show, I think this must be an exciting time for you, because it seems to me that the voice you're developing is a confluence of all of the factors that have taken place in your life over your lifetime, and you're really finding a great voice for them in the novels you're writing now.
Well, I'm not particularly self-conscious about my voice, the voice I present in the writing, but I did years ago when I was learning how to write. My model was Ben Webster. If I could only write like Ben Webster plays horn, maybe I'd have something. And I also would listen to Miles Davis from the Kind of Blue period. Mm-hmm. So I think most writers that I know and admire are people that have a sound in their work and a kind of music. Sometimes when you can't read somebody. For example, I have a terrible time trying to read Jane Austen. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. There's many theories that I have, but I'm not sure. But I don't hear the music, whereas I hear the music of many different types of writers, people that I don't write like. I hear Graham Greene. I hear Tom Wolfe. I hear Kerouac in some hours of the night.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is, for people who are beginning to write, they should be thinking about what the music is, what they want to sound like. It might be Gregorian chant, who knows? It could be Satie, it could be the Rolling Stones, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad that you said that. I don't feel that way. I can't stand back from my work and say each book is, you know, a deepening of the voice. I don't know.
Right, that you're too close.
Nobody else would have to say that.
Yeah. But I also look at the biography you wrote of Diego Rivera.
Right.
And Mexico has been an important part of your life, and I can see elements of that in North River.
Yes.
And the same with, you wrote a nice book that I would recommend to people, Why Sinatra Matters, and we see some of the themes in some of the characters, I think, in North River. So it's just, there's a lot of synergies going on here that I just found really came together quite well in North River.
Thank you. As you know, in North River, my doctor, Dr. Delaney, takes this woman, Rosa Verga, dancing because it looks as if they might be broken up by events, not by anything else, but events. And he takes her, of course, because her name is Rose, to Roseland. And there's a skinny singer from somewhere in New Jersey who begins to sing Life is Just a Bowl of Cherries. And, of course, in my head, it's a 19-year-old Frank Sinatra. So it's there, you're right, that the sound of popular music is there, the sound of the visions of popular movies. Fred Astaire is an offstage figure in this novel.
Yeah.
Because I think that's what happened during the Depression. People found ways to give themselves alternates to the grimness of life during the Depression and to believe in some pretty important things like love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to do a love story for grown-ups, you know, which is not like being hit by summer lightning. I never happens that way. It's what you see in the movies and what you remember. I once asked my father, when did you propose to Mom, to my mother? He says, in the balcony of the RKO Sanders. And he said, what was playing? And he said, something about snow. So I went and looked up the year, and of course the big hit that year was Call of the Wild. The Jack London.
The Jack London, yeah.
Which does take place during snow in Alaska or the Yukon or someplace. And he couldn't remember the name of it, but it was something about snow. I thought that would be a wonderful title for a short story.
Yes, yes. And Snow in August was is for book clubs that are looking for a great book to read and discuss. Snow in August is a wonderful book to fill that, category. And I would like to mention just in passing, you wrote in The Drinking Life, you talk about when you put the bottle down, you sat down and you wrote The Gift. And most of the times when I see a book like The Gift, and I'm so glad that Little Brown did a nice reissue of it.
It sure did.
Yeah, so many times those books, let's face it, you and I can be honest, they're fluff, they're trite. They take advantage of the season, and you buy them, and it's like getting a bad piece of chocolate or something. The Gift really is a very nicely told story, a very nice slice of life that I think falls outside that category of something that's kind of slammed together at the holidays to take advantage of like impulse sales, and I would recommend people read The Gift because it really. I think they learn a lot about the writer, Pete Hamill, and about the war and the effect. And you got an awful lot of information into a very short book with The Gift.
Well, thank you very much. Again, I think, the first novel I wrote was called A Killing for Christ, and it was a conventional thriller because I had never written anything longer than 2,000 or 3,000 words for magazines. Plus newspaper stuff. And so I wanted to find out how to be a long-distance runner in addition to a sprinter, and I wrote this novel knowing that with a thriller there were certain obligations that you had to take care of about structure and plot and all that. And so I learned how to do it in that. And then the next one was The Gift. In which I finally dug into what's my own subject matter, that world before television, the world of the children of the immigrants and their children in Brooklyn and other parts of New York City. And doing that, in that particular one, I start to find my own voice rather than the voice of 100 different thriller writers. So I'm glad you said what you did because I didn't recognize it until afterwards. I wasn't sitting down saying now I'll find my voice,
right.
But the voice came out of dealing with the world, a world that has vanished, and a world that predated the triumph of television. And in many ways, my work is. A lot of my other novels are about that, about that world, and what we were like when you had to learn from words and movies once a week and not images with soundtracks and laugh tracks.
Right, right. And there's a line in A Drinking Life where you said you realized you were kind of getting to the point where you were squeezing the toothpaste out of the toothpaste container.
Yeah.
And I love that.
In journalism. Right.
And I love that image because I think there's that fear of a loss of creativity when you make a major life change. And it's I think it's a false assumption that people make. But I love the imagery of that. And then now to see your prose as it is as developed is bears witness to that. And I think with North River, any great novel has to have a complex protagonist, and I think Dr. Delaney is a very great protagonist because he's complex. And that during the time period where you set this, 1934, that was a very complex period of time to live in. The answers weren't quite so black and white as they are today.
Right. Absolutely. And what I was trying to do was to suggest that complexity. The people that lived through the Depression, starting with my mother and father, but with everybody else I knew after the Depression was behind, and the war, were both behind us, 1945 on. And they were not cartoons of the left or the right. They were human beings, which is to say they're more than one dimension. When you get to know them, even as a kid, you could understand there was something bugging this one, or something special and secret and amazing about another one, even if you couldn't decode it very well. And I think, you know, doing that, the novel is not an essay, and it's not a lecture or a moral tale most of the time. But one of the things I wanted to do was to celebrate that complexity.
Mm-hmm.
Say, here you had these people. Bad times were upon them all, and the bad times were a great leveler in all kinds of ways. The blacks in Harlem and the Irish on the West Side were both wrecked by the same economic collapse. But there, within the groups, you could find generosity and decency and a sense of obligation for your neighbor and the truest kind of toughness. These were not people who talked tough. They were tough. And it was the toughness that allowed you to endure the things that you were afflicted with, which was mainly a lack of money and a lack of ambition beyond Friday, or dreaming of any kind of a future, and to get through it and keep getting up in the morning. And that was an amazing example for a whole generation of people, of which I'm one of them. You know, the children of that generation, we carry around with us now, even though almost everybody that instructed us is dead.
Mm-hmm.
We carry around with us those lessons, and we measure the world against them.
Mm-hmm.
And those lessons and those values were as good as anything I ever heard in a philosophy class or God knows on cable TV or
yeah.
anywhere else.
Yeah. Dr. Delaney turns to the classics at night when he wants to learn things.
Right.
And I thought
right.
of Robert Coles when you wrote that, the great writer and Dr. Robert Coles, who uses literature as a way to teach his medical students how to treat their patients. And because Dr. Delaney was more than a doctor, he's a therapist to his patients, and he has some things that he has to come up against, because some of the choices. There's a heartbreaking scene where a young mother comes to him, and she wants to bury her daughter, and it's just heartbreaking. And the whole thing they needed was money.
Yes.
The thing
about those doctors of that period, including my guy, and what I learned by reading and researching and cobbling together some doctors that I knew after the war that still made house calls. In 1934, the medicine was ahead of the science. So a guy like Delaney, a good, well-trained doctor, he could tell if somebody had tuberculosis or gonorrhea or whatever. He could not cure them because penicillin was, you know, up ahead almost 9 years. Sulfa drugs didn't come in until the very end of the 30s, and they were not available to everybody. So they were like Sisyphus. You know, they got up every morning and rolled that boulder up the hill, knowing it was going to roll down. And so the famous bedside manner that doctors developed was an act of human consolation to people. If you held their hands and spoke in a low, encouraging, warm voice, you might get them to live another day or a week or a year. And that, to me, was a heroic thing.
Not a
phony act to get you to get paid, because most of the time they didn't get paid. It was heroic that those people, like many other quiet kind of heroes, school teachers, for example, nurses, who were not heroic in a melodramatic way, and I'm not putting down firemen or cops or combat soldiers, you know, who are heroic, obviously, but there's all these other quiet heroes, of which Delaney is one, and we shouldn't forget them either. Because they're doing it now. There are school teachers in ghetto schools who are doing their best to get some little girl to learn how to read and some young boy to understand there's a world beyond the next block.
Yeah,
and they do it every day. And it's amazing how often they succeed just because they care about it, you know? And we should always remember those people.
Yes, absolutely. Pete, talk a little bit about Rose in North River, which has recently been published by Little Brown. She's a Sicilian woman, and one of the nice things about North River, I think, is that you really explore the nature of secrets that we all have in our lives.
Yes.
I don't think that's ever changed.
Yes. Yeah, I think that went on in the Garden of Eden. You know, I mean, there are things. Garcia Marquez, who you mentioned earlier, once said in an interview, we all have three lives. There's a public life, there's a private life, and then there's a secret life. If you're in a public life, if you take Jennifer Lopez to the Academy Awards, you're fair game, you know? You can only come into the private life at invitation. You can't come leaping over the balcony into somebody's life or house or anything, over the wall, rather. But the secret life is nobody's business. And it takes real confidence in the other person in your life, whether it's a husband, a wife, a lover, whatever it is, to reveal. If you so choose to reveal anything out of the secret life, most of the time it doesn't matter. It's who you are in the present that really truly counts. But sometimes something from the secret life will explain why you behave the way you are, the way you do in the present life. So you're absolutely right at nailing that theme underneath there. Again, I don't spell it out, I just show it, but he has a secret life too.
Yes.
There are things that he is ashamed of. There are things, you know, particularly the way he treated his first wife and going off to the war for idealistic purposes. That's happening right now in Texas. And the result of it is he never got to see his little girl walk. Learn how to walk, or go in the park and name the world the way he finally does with his grandson. So there's things that you have regrets or remorse about, and it's very difficult to talk about them. And there is a great argument for the statute of limitations.
Yes.
But they're there, and I think fiction is the place that is the form that handles that better than almost everything.
Yeah, I agree, because normally in real life, when you've come close enough to a person to share your secret, it actually brings you closer to them, and that's when true intimacy occurs, and that's magic.
Yes, it brings you closer and deeper.
Because at a certain level, the people that love us, they understand we've made mistakes, and they just don't care.
Yeah.
You know, as long as we don't continue to do it.
To admit that you made mistakes is to admit that you're human.
Yeah.
You know, that you're not a statue in the park, perfect and bronzed forever. but that you're a human. Human beings are imperfect. Thank God. You know, the ideal of the perfectibility of man and utopias to follow has filled the world with mountains of corpses. It's admitting that we're human and we make mistakes and we'll probably make more of them, but not the same ones, that I think makes us closer as people, not simply as husbands or wives, but as friends.
Yes.
Friends know the secrets and they don't care.
No.
You know?
No. Pete, there's a line on page 327, when I read it, I burst out laughing so loud that thankfully nobody was in the house. My wife would have thought I was crazy. But Delaney thinks, he's talking to his daughter, and he thinks to himself, "Save me, please, O Lord, from the banality of the young."
Well, I think, you know, that's what I mean about human and having a novel about grown-ups.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, that you can sure love a little girl or a young woman in particular who thinks that she's just discovered that the world is round. And by the way, men are even worse at this. Young women are generally smarter than young men.
No question.
Thank God.
Yeah.
But that notion of discovering something that's obviously become a banality to people who thought about it, is one of the things you got to cherish about having children and growing up or meeting young people. Young people can teach you that, among other things, they're young.
Yeah. And the relationship between Dr. Delaney and Carlito is really a beautiful relationship, because
thank you.
You go from this imposition which is forced upon him to it just brings him back to life, and now he can't imagine his life without this young kid running.
Yes.
And that's the way life is.
He doesn't want his daughter to come back.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
He knows she will, but he needs this boy. You know, when he meets the boy, he's as frozen as the river. And through the agency of the boy, doing what kids always do for us, you know, allowing you again to see the world with innocent eyes, as you begin to name it: tree, street, car, cornflakes, to be able to see again that innocently through the boy's eyes or the little girl's eyes, if he'd only been there for his daughter, is one of the things that's essential to the whole rhythm of a human life. And it's the boy more than the woman. The woman is there only because of the boy, but the boy is child shall lead you.
Yes.
It's one of those things.
Yes.
And I, by the way, when I was researching it, because I couldn't remember even my own two daughters when they were three.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't remember because I was running around chasing fires or homicides or something as a newspaper man. And I would go in the park and I would see a woman, you know, either a nanny taking care of a little boy or a mother or whatever, and I'd go over and talk to them, and they'd look at me first like I was somebody wanted on the Bill O'Reilly show for being a predator in Steubenville, Ohio.
Right.
But once they relaxed and talked to me about it, so many of them said basically the same things. I asked, what came first when they started talking, nouns or verbs? All nouns. They want to know the name of the world before they get to something as complicated as a verb. And the first verb invariably was, I want. I want hot dog. I want food. Or I want drink. And it was amazing talking to them because, I understood then how the dynamic would work. You're walking down a street with a three-year-old and he points at something and you have to tell him what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore you think about it again, which you hadn't. Fire engine. How do you explain that to a kid?
Mm-hmm.
So there is a kind of research, even in a novel, that's not journalistic, but learns from the tools of journalism to ask some questions.
Sure.
People will always talk to you.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. And Pete, one of the things, this was, I believe it was from your memoir, My Manhattan. It was a line that you wrote, and it really is stuck with me, talking about the biggest killer in New York is jealousy.
Yes.
And if you could explain that a little bit, because I agree with you, but I have a feeling you have a much better defined sense of what you were referring to when you wrote that line, because I think that's a very fascinating way to look at not only New York, but primarily New York. That is the biggest killer there.
Yeah, but it wasn't just New York. We see it happening all over the country, even now. You know, somebody will kill his wife and his kids or something, and you find out later that it's about something that's not left in the suicide note, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But when I talked, when I was a young reporter, you know, I would go cover homicides. Invariably, I would talk to the cops when they roll off, you know, when things calmed down, after I knew the caliber of the bullet and the time of the death and all that. And I asked one of them one time, well, what do people kill each other for in New York? Is it over money? Is it over... what is the cause of death? And the guy said, jealousy. What else? And it could be jealousy over status or rank or success, but invariably it was jealousy over the possessive nature of, that love can take. I used to have a file, I still have parts of it, called Love, and all it was about people who were shot, stabbed, poisoned, mutilated, or whatever, because they switched their affections from one person to another. They ended up with a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and the wife killed them, or the guy killed the wife, or the, you know, the variations are not that wide. It's always a similar story in some way. And the formulas of it, I mean, the basic structures of those quarrels go on to this day. I don't know how many we lose every year in New York, but I would bet it'd be a couple of hundred out of 500 murders. You know, there could be drug deals gone wrong that are not jealousy. Or stick-ups or something like that. But primarily, it's how could you leave me for him or something.
Yeah, right.
You know, some variations on it. Human beings being human beings, this is not news.
Right.
In a strange way. The details are always news, but the big plot is always the same.
Yeah. Pete, I really appreciate all the time you've given us today. And looking back on North River now that it's in the stores and you're out promoting it, what is it that you're happiest about that you accomplished with North River? Some of the fan reaction you're getting back. What's the happiest takeaway for you right now, would you say?
Well, that people who have read it like the people who were in it. Because it was one of those books where I wanted, you know, it's very hard to write a book in which you hate the principal.
Yes.
You got to live with a book, the writing of a book for a couple of years, maybe 3 years or 4 years. You don't want to live with Hitler, you know,
right.
Or Goebbels. You want somebody, some people that you like.
Yeah.
But the initial reactions after less than 2 weeks, looking at emails and giving readings is, I really like these people. And that pleases me, because the people that I was celebrating, that generation of my neighbors who helped show us all how to be human in the best way without losing, without humiliating ourselves, that generation, I think, is on the pages of this book, starting with my mother and father, but including everybody else, the Italians and the Jews and the Germans who all shared a calamity and came out of it better, as their children did, I think. When people talk about that, I had a grandmother who, you know, and they begin
right.
to tell a story.
Right.
And it's almost always an example or a parable of human decency.
Good.
When I hear those tales, and I know that that's what I was after in the writing of this book, that maybe I succeeded.
Great. Well, I can't recommend the book strongly enough, North River by Pete Hamill. And Pete, thanks again. It's been a real pleasure. I've enjoyed. I would also recommend people, after you read North River, go back and read Mr. Hamill's other writings. There's a Why Sinatra Matters. It's a beautiful tribute to Sinatra, where you learn a lot of things about Sinatra that I never knew about and found very fascinating. And so there, you've read the piece on Diego Rivera. I mean, very well-written books that that I think that true readers will enjoy reading.
Thank you very much.
And we'll catch up with you down the road.
See you. I'll talk to you when I finish the current book.
That sounds good.
Or when it ever gets to the newsstands, we'll see.
Okay, Pete.
Thanks so much.
Okay, take care.